Well, tonight we want to enter the 20th century, but I'm still stuck at the end of the 19th, actually. We're talking about the history of the Alaskan Mission, and we've spoken about St. Herman and St. Innocent and St. Yakov Netsvietov and the Alaskan martyrs, St. Juvenali and St. Peter the Aleut. We could add to this constellation of holy people St. Patriarch Tikhon, who was also bishop of the Aleutian Islands and North America, but had a vicar bishop appointed, Bishop Innocent II, in 1905. So the Bishop Innocent that we now have in our diocese, the Diocese of Alaska, Bishop Innocent, is actually Bishop Innocent III. He has the right to a Roman numeral, you see, after his name. We've had three Bishop Innocents of the Alaskan Diocese. St. Tikhon, of course, returned to Russia before the revolution, and I often say, I don't mean it in disrespect, but he kind of won the booby prize of church history, because during the Russian bombardment, the Bolshevik bombardment of the Kremlin, he was at the last moment elected patriarch. As the all Russian council voted to restore the patriarchate, he was also then chosen to be the patriarch of Russia at the most difficult time, perhaps, in the history of the Russian Orthodox Church, because it was he then who had to shoulder the burden and the brunt of the Bolshevik persecutions up into the 1920s, and died under house arrest in Donskoy Monastery. He was buried secretly, and no one quite knew exactly where. Strangely enough, and this is certainly providential, about 5 years ago now, I think, someone, even though the Soviet power had collapsed, firebombed one of the churches at the Donskoy Monastery. And the fire was quickly extinguished. However, it was just enough to burn through the floors, the floorboards. And in the process of restoring the floor, they found under the floor the grave of someone. They opened the coffin and found him wrapped in the green mantle of the Patriarch of Moscow. So they discovered, after all these years, because of an act of evil, really, against the church, they found the relics of St. Tikhon. So St. Patriarch Tikhon was canonized, and his body lies in one of the two churches. They actually, on certain days, move him from one church to the other, one of the two main churches in the Donskoy Monastery. And he also, you see, visited Alaska and is also connected to the Alaskan church and the church in America. It was under him that the Hapgood service book was printed. You can look in the front of your Hapgood, the service book that we all use and have been using most of this century, published in English, Vespers, Matins, the Hours and such, at least extracts from most of the major feasts. And it was the only service book in English available for probably the majority of this century. And it was he who commissioned it and had it printed and fostered the use of the English language in keeping with St. Innocent's directives from 1868, who already insisted 50 years earlier that clergy who spoke English should be assigned to America, the bishop should speak English and be multilingual if possible, and services as quickly as possible should be celebrated in the English language in North America, all of which took a lot longer to come to fruition, to be implemented because of the difficult historical circumstances facing the church after 1867 with the transfer of Alaska to American rule. It's very interesting. Maybe we should comment on that for one moment. You remember Vitus Bering in 1741, Alexei Chirikov, came with brass plaques that said, this land is under Russian protection. It could also possibly be translated, this land is under Russian rule. But protection is the actual translation. We've only ever located one of these, and it's in Sitka, and it's mistranslated in the display case. It says, this land belongs to Russia. There's a difference between being under the protection of a government and that person owning the place. The American government is responsible for protecting Alaska, but the United States government doesn't own all of Alaska. You have the deed to your house, supposedly, and that's your property. It's not federal property. There's plenty of federal property here, to be sure. But people also have their own. And the same was true in Alaska during the Russian times. What was sold for $7.2 million in 1867 was this protection, this sovereignty. The Russian flag went down, the American flag went up. People stopped using rubles and started using dollars. The postage stamps, if you could find them, were American rather than Russian and so forth. The American government became the government of Alaska. The Russian government ceased being the government of Alaska. That and the assets of the Russian-American Company. The treaty explicitly lists the the wharfs, the warehouses, the docks, the buildings that are being sold. It's a kind of going out of business sale of this monopoly begun by Gregory Shelikov. And it didn't go very smoothly, by the way. They tried to reenact the transfer ceremony, which occurred October 18, 1867 at Sitka. Every year on October 18th, an Alaskan state holiday called Alaska Day, appropriately, people dress in costumes and some pretend that they're the Russian governor and other the American guards. And Colonel Rousseau, the American colonel reads, the person impersonating him, that is, reads the same words that were said back then. But you could never completely and accurately reenact the original transfer ceremony. First of all, they put the flags on 60-foot Sitka spruce trees, very high trees, so that people from all over could see the Russian and American flag. The Russian flag was there, and the American flag was going to be raised as the Russian flag was lowered, simultaneously. And then the cannon, the battery on shore, were to begin firing the salute, and it was to be answered by the American boat in the harbor, so that both flags would be saluted by this 18-gun salute, I think it was. Well, about halfway down the flagpole, the Russian flag got stuck. Still 40 feet or so off the ground, and they kept pulling it, and nothing was going. And the wind was blowing so strongly that the flag, in fact, wrapped itself around the flagpole. Some sailors from the garrison decided to try to shimmy up the pole and bring it down, but they got about halfway up and ran out of steam. So at this point, you have a rather ridiculous situation of the cannon still going off because the people aboard the ship and the people lighting the cannon were oblivious to what was going on the flagpole. The salute was fired all right, but the flag wasn't come down, and now we have sailors up there stuck halfway up on this flagpole. Finally, an Indian man was using some ropes, was hoisted up, and the wind was so strong they were calling him, "Bring it down, bring it down," but he didn't hear them, so he took out a knife and he began cutting the Russian flag from its. And when he finally freed it, it came floating down and covered the Russian honor guard. At which point, the Russian governor's wife fainted. And this is how Alaska was really transferred to American rule. These are eyewitness accounts that later were published in American newspapers, but they had it all, you know, with great dignity. It didn't quite work that way. Now we can't possibly reenact that. The flags go up rather quickly. They're metal, and they're only about 20 feet high, and so forth. The reenactment goes very smoothly, but the original act, the original ceremony, was rather a comedy of errors. Immediately after the sale, the American government virtually did nothing with their new territory. It wasn't until 1884 that the Congress of the United States made any provision for the government of Alaska. So from 1867 to 1884, nothing. No schools, no post offices. Not even any military guard. There was a customs tax collector at Sitka. That was it. That was the federal government presence in Alaska. Some people would welcome a reduction of that sort nowadays, but it meant that there were really no government services provided in the colony in the nearly 20 years immediately following the transfer ceremony. And it was a transfer of sovereignty. It was not, from the Russian perspective, a land sale. Congress debating the treaty already had it calculated at 2 cents an acre or something like that, even cheaper than Louisiana. Of course, there were others who were against it because they said it was just a bunch of ice and rocks and snow and walruses. And you have anti-sale cartoons in American newspapers opposing spending so much money, $7.2 million, for this worthless piece of real estate. Well, of course, they were. We know how wrong they really were, but in fact, it wasn't 2 cents an acre either, because it wasn't a land deal. They were buying the assets of the Russian American Company, which were here and there, like buying Sears, you know. And then they were receiving sovereignty. And the land, the treaty says, belongs to those who live on it, therefore the indigenous people. If you want an easy explanation for the Land Claims Settlement Act of 1971, it's precisely because the Native Alaskans, reading the treaty, said, you can't build that pipeline across our land. And the federal government said, well, it's our land. Remember, we bought it from Russia. And they said, read the treaty. And so Alaska is the only state that had to be bought twice. Sovereignty was purchased for $7.2 million in 1867. The land was not bought until 1971. The native people refused to sell all of it because, after all, they need some for their subsistence lifestyle. So one-fifth of the state remains in native hands. It's often interpreted exactly the other way, that the government gave land to the natives. Not at all. The native Alaskans kept the land they wanted and sold the rest of Alaska to the United States, extinguishing their claim to the majority of the real estate, 80% of Alaska, for about $1 billion, which actually still comes out to be something of a bargain, even at 1971 prices. In any case, that's the, and St. Innocent played some role in that. And some Aleuts in St. Petersburg paid some role, a role in that, to make sure that their people wouldn't be deprived of their rights in Alaska after the transfer. Russian citizens, which meant all these people we're talking about so far, were given the option to either stay in America and become American citizens and declare so within 3 years, or return to Siberia, also within 3 years. Nearly all those who had been born in Siberia left. Virtually no Russian citizens who had actually come from Siberia or Russia remained. They all simply, they were on 7-year contracts, remember. They had never come to Alaska as permanent settlers anyway. So they went back. It's perfectly understandable. Schools, churches, businesses, shops continued to operate, operated by those Aleuts with whom we concluded yesterday. The literate native population, who comprised 60% of the population of Sitka, 90% of the population of Kodiak, and so forth. They, business as usual, their Russian friends went home, but they had been educated, they were literate, they were running their own shops and stores, and they were the ones who expanded the mission after Alaska became American territory. So the church continued to grow. And then, thanks to the Mission Society, whose organization we discussed yesterday, funds and material came from Russia to continue the expansion of the Orthodox Church in Alaska. In 1894, for example, exactly 100 years after the first missionaries, some Tlinkets in Juneau were under some Presbyterian pressure to become Christians. And they went shopping the way St. Prince Vladimir did in 988. One of their chiefs was having a recurring dream in which a short, balding, white-bearded man appeared to him and encouraged him to become a Christian, but he didn't know of what sort. And being the chief, he sent one of his sons, Dmitri was his later baptismal name, to Sitka to find out about this church over there. And the son Dmitri came back not only baptized, but with a small icon of St. Nicholas. And the chief said, "That's him." And so they sent for Bishop Nikolai, the patterns repeat here too, and 200 Tlinkets received baptism in Juneau. And then 200 silver rubles were sent from Moscow to buy the lumber, the blueprints, the icons, the candle stands, the epitaphios, the plastionitsa, the banners, the chalice, the censer. They equipped the full church. It just came in the mail, so to speak. From the Missionary Society in Russia, and it's still there. It's the oldest continuously in use chapel in Southeast Alaska, but it was not built by any missionary initiative. The native people themselves requested the baptism, sent for the bishop. It sounds very much like the Indian people I talked about last night, the people in Chagaluk who invited St. Yakov to come and baptize them. There's absolutely no indication here of any sort of political or social advantage to this conversion, nor certainly is there even less any coercion on the part of any authorities. If anything, the authorities were militantly against the Orthodox Church by this time. If we want to very quickly review interracial relations in the United States during the last 500 years, we have 300 years when the policy, the colonial policy and then the federal policy toward indigenous peoples, was one of extermination. It's not a very happy thing to say, but it's simply so. Scalping, as I think I mentioned before, there was a bounty on Indians. And if you could prove that you had killed an Indian or two, you could get money for that. And this was policy for these 300 years. And of course, for Africans, it's enslavement during this time. From 1800 to 1850, we have a slightly more enlightened policy. It's removal. Native people are removed to the west, The Cherokee Trail of Tears is in this era, when you just say to those people who are kind of cluttering your own landscape, move west, the Mississippi, Oklahoma's a good place for you. And under military escort, the southern tribes of what were the tribes of east of the Mississippi are moved to Oklahoma. From the north, they're moved to South Dakota. These were considered to be two completely worthless pieces of real estate. Of course, later we found oil in one and gold in the other. They weren't so worthless after all. But this is the time when treaties are signed with Indian tribes that whatever land is left or willed to them will be theirs as long as the grass is green, the sun shines, the rain falls, and so forth. And removal is also applied to freed slaves. This is when Liberia gets founded, and African slaves, freed slaves, are put on boats and sent back to Africa. If they couldn't afford trips to Africa, Nicaragua was runner-up. So that the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua is also settled by freed American slaves from the United States. But this is how you deal with people who are different from you. It's the tribal attitude, the first one, remember? If people are racially, culturally different from yourself, the safest way to deal with them is to get rid of them, physically annihilate them. And this is an age-old attitude. And by the way, it exists in us. It's not just something in the past. There are children on kindergarten playgrounds around the world who, meeting another kid racially or culturally different from themselves, or somehow or other inspired to beat them up, to attack. There are skinheads around who still think that that's the right way to deal with the issue. But in the United States, at least as policy goes, by the early 1800s, the policy was removal instead. You're different from us, but therefore please get out of the way. And kids will do this too. They have a disagreement with someone, get off my property, go home. I mean, it's in a sense not just a policy or part of our history, it's an apparent solution when you're having trouble with someone who's different from you in some way. Now, after the Civil War, and this is where our Alaskan story picks up, from 1870 to 1970, we have assimilation as a policy. We couldn't ask people who were different to leave, because we put up the Statue of Liberty and just invited them to come. You're tired, you're poor, you're huddled masses, and they showed up. You see, this was the problem. Suddenly you don't have people from Britain and Northwestern Europe, Scandinavian and Germanic types. Now after the Civil War you have mostly Italians and Greeks and people from the Balkans and Eastern Europe. And they don't speak languages intelligible and aren't even considered refined. We have barbarians. And in fact, Harper's Weekly calls these people barbarians. They're illiterate, you see. We come full circle. It's exactly what the Frankish German bishops were saying about the Slavs in the 9th century. Now we're in the 19th century, 1,000 years later. But these languages are not civilized languages. Of course, the civilized languages are no longer Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. It's much more French, German, and English, the real European languages. And Polish doesn't qualify, you see. And almost none of these people are Protestant. These are Jewish immigrants, Roman Catholic immigrants, and of course, Eastern Orthodox immigrants. What to do now? We can't kill them. We just invited them in, and we need their labor. That we want them to work in our mines and our factories. In the years after the Civil War, there's tremendous economic boom in the United States. And we're not going to ask them to leave, we just invited them in. But what will happen to the country if we let things just go the way they are? And there's a McCarthy-esque paranoia in the press, in the newspapers and magazines for 20 or 30 years. What to do? What have we done? This is radically going to change the social fabric of the country. We're going to have people of different languages, different religions, and different races, because those Greeks and Italians didn't look white enough. And now we've got the slaves freed. What next? It's a lot of turmoil, social and political turmoil during these years, what to do. And the public schools are founded, state by state, not to so much assimilate the immigrants, because they went right to work, but their children. The children are, by law, required to attend school. And this is why we had prayer in the public schools, It wasn't because these children were not religious. They just went to the wrong church. And the public schools did not mandate anybody's religious practices. They mandated Protestant religious practices. You prayed to pray like an American meant to pray as a Protestant Christian. That's why the Roman Catholic Church refused to participate and built their own parochial schools. Because they saw this as a real threat to their existence, to their survival in America. For most immigrants, however, they came in order to fit in. They were glad to be here. My grandmother was happy to see her kids go to the first school they could have ever attended. So they were going to learn English. They were going to learn how to fit in. They were going to become Americans, which was the whole point of coming across the Atlantic Ocean in the first place. So assimilation actually worked for the overwhelming majority of immigrants. It did not work nearly so well for Aleuts. You can imagine what happened when the first public school teachers came to Alaska, to people who already could read and write in two languages. The Aleuts who knew Russian and their own language. And the teacher said, "I came to teach you to read and write." And they said, "Very good, but we actually already do." They said, "Well, we came to baptize you and make you good Christians." They said, "Thank you very much, but we already are." At which point the teacher had to say, "Wrong languages and wrong religion." And you wind up with 30 years, we have the documents. It's really 30 years of not just Cold War, but sometimes hot war. Between the public school teacher, who is in Alaska always a missionary of some American Protestant group, always. That's how they were appointed. Among the Indian tribes in the lower 48, various denominations were given reservations so that a particular tribe was to be evangelized by a particular church. And they were federally subsidized. It was church and state working hand in glove. So that I can tell you in Alaska who got what. The Presbyterian Church got Southeast Alaska because the Commissioner of Education, Sheldon Jackson, was himself a Presbyterian minister. They also got the North Slope by default because nobody else wanted to go up there. Because the Anglicans, the Episcopal Church, had already begun penetrating down the Yukon from Canada, they were given the interior, and most of the area in red here, the Athabascan area, was Episcopal Church mission territory. The Baptists were given Kodiak Island, which is why the oldest non-Orthodox mission in Kodiak is the Baptist mission. The Methodists were given the Aleutian Islands. The Moravian Church was given the Bristol Bay area. The Swedish Covenant Church was given Nunavak Island. The Society of Friends, the Quaker Church, was given Kotzebue and the surrounding area. The Lutherans got Nome. And if you travel throughout Alaska, you can tell that those are the only churches that of any long standing there. Other groups have moved in. You know, you can find here and there an Assembly of God mission or a Pentecostal church that have more recently been transplanted from the lower 48. But the Alaska was divided into spheres of influence, and the federal government provided this. The public school teachers, you see, were underpaid as civil servants, and so the mission societies of each denomination supplemented their income. So you had a missionary federal school teacher who had the governor and all the weight of the federal government behind them, and usually an Aleut native priest, running his own bilingual school in the same town. It's very interesting, in the 1880s, Sheldon Jackson, as Commissioner of Education, wrote a letter to the Orthodox Bishop of Alaska and asked for the list of where Orthodox missions and particularly schools were located. He said, "It's silly, I have limited resources. There's no reason to have two schools in the same town when there's so many towns with no school at all." So Bishop Nicolai, I think rather naively, complied with Sheldon Jackson's request. And then Dr. Jackson put schools in exactly the towns where the Orthodox had their schools. Because the Orthodox bilingual schools were sort of the antithesis of the kind of school the federal government wanted. They wanted to assimilate Native Alaskans. And you can't assimilate them if you're going to let them speak their own language and teach them to read and write in it. They were supposed to melt into the same melting pot as the immigrants. It was simply the same policy from the lower 48, transplanted to a different context. Famous word this whole week, right? And because the context was different, it didn't work. The immigrant came voluntarily, and they had a homeland on the other side of the Atlantic to where they could return if they so desired. And by the way, 30% went back. They didn't like America that much. First of all, there were no feast days here. They had no fun. You know, in the old country, a wedding lasted at least 3 days, sometimes a week. In America, it lasted 5 minutes. What kind of culture is this? And people actually returned saying, we'd all be rich like America if we were that crazy to work like that, to work all the time and never relax and have a good time and enjoy our communities, our villages, and so forth. So a third returned. But those who came, they came in order to fit in, and they knew that there was a homeland back there to which they could return if they wanted to. The native peoples were just sitting here, minding their own business, and suddenly, well, I'll describe how the school arrives. In other words, they hadn't immigrated, they hadn't gone to another country to become something that they weren't. They were just here being who they had always been, the way we always, and suddenly someone comes and says, that's no good anymore. Secondly, if they give up their language and culture, there is no other place to return to. It's gone. This is home. If Tlingit is no longer spoken in Tlingit country here in Alaska, it's extinct. If a Polish immigrant doesn't speak Polish, there's still a Poland. But if a Yupik doesn't speak Yupik, Bishop Seraphim of Canada calls the Yupik area Yupikia. Well, if you don't speak Yupik in Yupikia, then Yupik culture and language is gone. It's dead. So for these two reasons, the assimilationist policy that worked so well for most immigrants completely failed, in my opinion, among Native Alaskans, at least in the first half century. Instead, you have fights, you have petitions, you have protests. And they're not only about the schools. The Tlingit Orthodox Aleut people, both Tlingit and Unangan and Sukhbiak, three different cultural groups, wrote a petition to the President of the United States, it's William McKinley, 1897. And it starts off very innocently saying, well, you know, we've sent you several such petitions, but we never got an answer. They infer some subordinate must have got a hold of them, but now we hope that this gets right through to you. And this got published in the newspaper, so perhaps the president actually did read it. There are 3 points in the Tlingit petition. The governor, a Presbyterian governor in league with the Sheldon Jackson, Mr. Brady, is rather enterprising. He sees the economic and commercial possibilities of being governor of Alaska. And so the first point in their petition to the president refers to Governor Brady. Not one. Do not allow Mr. Brady a right-of-way through the center of our village along the beach, which is situated between the water and our homes, where we keep our boats, canoes, and other things. Forbid him to destroy buildings and other property while building this road. We do not offer pretensions to the land he now possesses, which was ours from time immemorial, and served us as a cemetery. It's bad enough that he unlawfully took possession of that land, and with the bones of our ancestors, he banked the ground and threw some into the ocean. We do not wish to have such work going on. 2, we beg Mr. Smith and the superintendent of the Baranoff Packing Company, how appropriately named, to be forbidden to take away our bays, streams, and lagoons where we have fished since long before the white man came. We want him to do such fishing as is necessary for him with our permission. We demand he stop putting up bars and fish traps across the streams whereby the fish cannot enter the lakes for the purpose of spawning. His method of fishing in the last 8 years, and they list the bays, compels us to see very plainly that the places mentioned here are becoming empty of fish. So the first is we shouldn't have the governor driving a road through our village and destroying our buildings and especially desecrating our cemetery. It's a reasonable request, I think. The second, that the cannery shouldn't be allowed to simply deplete the entire salmon. It's a conservation plea here. Third, and this is really one that grabs you, we do not want American saloons. We beg the government to close them. We understand that whiskey is poison for us. Tramps and idle people, like soldiers and sailors, that's their words, not mine, bring whiskey into our midst from those saloons. They give it to our wives and daughters and make them drunk and often seduce them in this condition. We have brought these cases to the local authorities here, and the result is that the white man goes free and unpunished while the native suffers fines, imprisonment, and punishment. Saloons and other places of amusement of such caliber are not necessary for the welfare of our daughters. Wonderful statement.
We do not want the civilization, and I take this with tongue in cheek, it's sarcastic. We do not want that civilization that only does not stop Saloons, but encourages them.